Hi, this is Kathy, and I'll be reading the Salem News for Wednesday, June 10th, 2026. Suit claims city violated state laws. A lawsuit has been filed against the city claiming Salem officials violated state laws by using public resources to promote the high school project vote and that the ballot language was changed between approval by the city council and when it was placed on the ballot. The suit was filed June 4th in Essex Superior Court by attorney John Carr on behalf of 20 Salem residents against the city, Mayor Dominic Pangallo, and the Salem High School Building Committee. The suit claims the city violated state law by using the Salem Council on Aging's newsletter, Senior Power, to publish an advocacy letter with allegedly false statements and a call to vote on the Proposition 2.5 debt exclusion vote held on May 5th. Additionally, the suit claims the city violated the same state law by using the Salem High School Building Committee website to maintain a tax impact calculator that they claim systematically favored a yes vote outcome. The suit argues that these two instances constituted a use of public resources and official position to influence a ballot question in violation of Anderson v. City of Boston, a 1978 Supreme Court case that ruled that government entities cannot spend public funds or use government resources to influence the outcome of elections, including ballot questions. According to the suit, the Office of Campaign and Political Finance confirmed the prohibition extends to all public resources, including websites, staff time, equipment, publications, and government email systems, and that it applies regardless of whether the material is labeled educational or informational. The suit alleges that the commercial tax impact calculator contains methodological defects by using the cost of the new construction option with the Massachusetts School Building Authority reimbursement factored in comparison to the renovation option that would result from a no vote on the debt exclusion. The suit claims that comparing these two numbers without the consideration of MSBA reimbursement, the new construction option at $447 million exceeds the cost of the code upgrade at $353 million, the opposite of what the calculator implies by using the $232 million figure for the yes vote calculation that factors in the reimbursement. Additionally, the suit claims there was a 3.5% annual cost escalation rate applied to the code upgrade option that wasn't applied to the new building option. The calculator also assumed a 4.25% interest rate for 30-year municipal bonds, which the suit alleges may understate actual Massachusetts municipal bond market rates at the time of configuration, understating the taxpayer's actual projected annual cost. The same claims of methodological defects are alleged about the mayor's letter published in Senior Power 5 weeks before the May 5th vote, as it uses the same figures derived from the tax calculator. In addition, the suit claims the letter includes misleading statements such as how a no vote would result in Salem's sales tax dollars flowing instead to places that have already approved school projects like Lexington. The suit argues this is materially false as the MSBA reimbursement is not a zero-sum mechanism that transfers identifiable Salem sales tax revenues to named communities based on local vote outcomes and are instead allocated through a statewide prioritization process. The mayor's letter also states the special election is a vote on whether we should accept the $208 million state grant and proceed with the desperately needed project, which the suit argues is factually inaccurate in a material and consequential way, as the MSBA grant acceptance is a separate administrative action that the city can take independent of the debt exclusion vote outcome. The MSBA's approval of the grant on February 28th dictated that the city had 120 days to finalize the local funding commitment, which was not specifically contingent upon the debt exclusion vote being approved. The third claim that the suit alleges is that the debt exclusion ballot language authorized by the Salem City Council on January 8th, which did not conform to language dictated by state law, was replaced by corrected, compliant language for the May 5th ballot without a recorded public vote, creating a break in the required chain of authorization. Because the city is expected to move toward bond authorization in the coming months, The suit seeks a declaratory judgment establishing the unlawfulness of the city's conduct and an injunction preventing the bond issuance until the court has resolved the questions of legality. The city said that costs related to the new high school will appear on tax bills once permanent financing is in place and long-term bonds are issued, which the city has tentatively scheduled for spring 2028. Pangallo said the city would not comment on pending litigation in response to an inquiry about the suit. The city has until October 2nd to file a response to the initial complaint. Ipswich Boys Lacrosse forfeits state semifinal game. The Ipswich High Boys Lacrosse team was looking forward to facing top-seeded Cohasset High in the Massachusetts Interscholastic Athletic Association's Division IV playoff semifinals Tuesday night in Scituate. Instead, the Tigers were forced to forfeit the game Tuesday afternoon. Multiple sources told the Salem News that the reason was due to a violation of the MIAA's chemical health rule, with multiple players reportedly smoking cigars after Ipswich High's graduation this past Sunday. There were enough players involved that the Tigers were not able to field an 11-man varsity team for their scheduled semifinal against the Skippers of Cohasset. The MIAA's chemical health policy states that during the entire academic year, a student shall not, regardless of the quantity use or consume, possess, buy, sell, or give away any beverage containing alcohol, any tobacco product, marijuana, steroids, or any controlled substance. It is not a violation for a student to be in possession of a legally defined drug specifically prescribed for the student's own use by his or her doctor. The year begins with the first day of fall practice. For a first-time violation of this rule, the MIAA website says that the students shall lose eligibility for the following interscholastic contests, totaling 25% of all interscholastic contests in that sport. School administrators could not be reached for comment, but the Ipswich High School website posted the following statement Tuesday afternoon. Ipswich High School was very excited to have its boys lacrosse team advance to the Division IV state semifinals that were scheduled for Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. The team and coaching staff decided that due to the shortage of available players, that it was in the best interest of the team to forfeit the game. We congratulate all of our players and coaches on a great season and for advancing to the Final Four. The MIAA released its own one-word statement saying, "It has been informed by Ipswich High School that it is forfeiting its 2026 Division IV boys lacrosse semifinal game." Seeded number 4 in the Division IV playoff bracket, Ipswich had been hoping to win its first MIAA boys lacrosse state championship since 2017 and its third in program history. It had previously defeated Tingsboro 18-1, Lunenburg 17-1, and Winthrop 14-8, all on their home turf in the first three rounds of the state playoffs. The Tigers will finish the season with a 14-4 record. They will also graduate a dozen seniors from the 2026 squad. After facing anti-Semitism, Peabody Rabbi calls for empathy. A local rabbi is encouraging the public to practice empathy after he and his family experienced several anti-Semitic incidents last month. Rabbi Nechshima Schusterman, the leader of Shabbat of Peabody, shared in a Facebook post with nearly 6,000 likes that his teenage son was walking down a Peabody street on May 23rd when a man driving with a child in the car spat out of his window and called the boy a dirty Jew as he passed by. He also shared that a week before, in separate incidents that also took place in Peabody, someone in a passing car shouted Heil Hitler at Schusterman's brother-in-law as he walked to synagogue, and another person shouted Free Palestine at Schusterman while he was walking down the street. Though the latter phrase is a political statement on its face, at that moment, in the context of Schusterman visibly appearing Jewish, it felt targeted, he said. Schusterman confronted the driver who shot back with expletive Jews and told the rabbi to assault his daughters. "He had no idea of my thoughts on the Middle East before he yelled out," Schusterman told the Salem News this week. "Seeing me as a Jew caused him to make that statement, which right there shows you the lack of distinction between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in a post-October 7th world, and that's sad." Schusterman was referring to the day members of Hamas killed about 1,200 people in Israel and took another 250 hostages in 2023, igniting the most violent era of conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians since Israel became an independent nation in 1948. Between October 7, 2023 and early March of this year, the United Nations estimates that more than 72,000 Palestinians have been killed in attacks on the Gaza Strip by the Israeli government, with 171,000 more injured. With the events going on in the Middle East, there's real suffering, just genuine suffering, Schusterman said. Anyone who can say that they don't feel the plight of those who are affected by this war are heartless, and I say that regarding the parties on both sides of this conflict. To assume someone's views based on the actions of a government is wrong, he continued. Harassing them for it, or simply for their religion, even more so. Frankly, very few people know my actual politics, Schusterman said. My job is to teach the beauty of Judaism and the messages of morality and ethics that can be taught to all Jews and Gentiles alike, and I should be able to walk from my house to my synagogue without being harassed. When multiple anti-Semitic events happen in close proximity, you know that there's something going on in the culture that needs to be fixed and healed, he said. We need some greater awareness, greater education, and we need to, as a community, say this is not okay. Schusterman reported the incidents to the Peabody Police Department. He's received a great deal of support from city officials and the department, he said, and noted Peabody as a whole has been welcoming to people of his faith. Both he and Peabody Police Captain David Bonfanti encouraged community members to report any instances of hate they experienced to police. We take every incident seriously, Bonfanti said. Sometimes we find out that a crime didn't occur, but we document it and we watch it and we always try to make people feel safe with extra patrols. We encourage any community member that is feeling unsafe to call us so we can add that extra support and help figure out a solution. In addition to notifying police, anti-Semitic incidents can also be reported to the Anti-Defamation League and to local synagogue leaders, Schusterman said. Not much came out of the police investigation as there's limits on what you can do about speech, he said. People are allowed to hate you. They're even allowed to say something hateful to you as long as it's not something threatening to you, he said. But just because you can doesn't mean you should. That's part of the lesson Schusterman hopes others will learn from his family's recent experiences. In Jewish tradition, there's an expression that knowing the illness is half the cure, he said. We have to know the illness, that there's a lack of education, there's a lot of false information going around, and to recognize that we have a problem. Food at 400 plus. 12-day festival to honor Salem's culinary past and present. Starting this Thursday, Salem Food Tours will be presenting a 12-day festival honoring Salem's 400th anniversary through the city's culinary history and contemporary food culture. In partnership with a broad coalition of historic properties, celebrated chefs, local restaurants, artists, and community organizations, Salem Food Tours will invite residents and visitors to experience Salem through food history, art, film, farming, and hospitality. The event, titled Food at 400 Plus, will include programming across Salem's downtown and waterfront, with events ranging from free historic home open houses and speaker programs to historically inspired restaurant menus, craft beverages, food-themed films, an urban farm visit, and a ticketed event featuring celebrity chef Scott Conant. Salem Food Tours, founded in 2012 by Karen Scalia, runs a year-round food and cultural walking tours exploring Salem's spice trade history and modern-day culinary science. Scalia said that with the festival's wide range of events, there's something on the menu for everyone. Food at 400 Plus is a celebration of everything that makes Salem exceptional. Four centuries of history, resilience, creativity, and community brought vividly to life through the universal language of food, Scalia said. For 400-plus years, Salem's story has been shaped by its harbor, its people, and the exchange of ideas and cultures. For 14-plus years, our tours have shined a light on this. The festival's premier event, An Evening with Chef Scott Conant, will take place on Saturday, June 13th at the Sophia Gordon Performing Arts Center at Salem State University. The award-winning celebrity chef, restaurateur, cookbook author, and television personality is also a 13th-generation direct descendant of Roger Conant, Salem's founder. Tickets are available through Eventbrite by searching An Evening with Chef Scott Conant. In addition to the ticketed event, the festival will include a range of free public programming. The family-friendly Food at 400-plus exhibit, sponsored by the Salem Witch Museum, will feature local and special exhibits, interactive presentations, and a speaker series exploring Salem's foodways, history, and evolving community identity. During the festival's first weekend, June 13th and 14th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., 9 historic house museums and locations across Salem will open their doors with special exhibits. Some houses will feature takeaways such as recipe cards or historically inspired cookies. A complimentary trolley provided by Salem Trolley will loop to participating sites on both days. More than 17 restaurants across the city will participate in the festival through Dine Back in Time, a 12-day culinary program featuring historically inspired menu items. Participating restaurants include Ledger, Finn's, Old Main Street Pub, Bambolina, The Babe, Sea Level, Turner's Seafood, The Lobster Shanty, Adriatic, and additional local favorites. Organizers strongly recommend weekend reservations. Food has always been one of the ways people experience a place and connect with one another. Aaron Chambers, chef and co-owner of Settler and Bernadette, two of the participating restaurants, said, "That connection to place is at the heart of how we cook. Working with local fishermen, farmers, and producers to create food that reflects where we are and the season we're in." The companion Sip Back in Time program will showcase historically inspired libations from Salem area brewers, cider makers, and distillers. Cinema Salem will screen 3 food-themed films during the festival, including Tampopo, Jiro Dreams of Sushi, and Big Night. On Saturday, June 13th, from 9:30 to 11 a.m., guests may also visit Mack Park Farm, a Salem urban agriculture initiative that produces thousands of pounds of pesticide-free food each season in support of local food assistance programs. A complimentary trolley shuttle will depart from Old Town Hall for the farm visit at 9:30 a.m. For the full schedule, restaurant participants, tickets, and event details, visit www.foodat400.com. Bars to stay open until 3 a.m. for World Cup fans. When the world's largest sporting event gets underway in the United States this month, Massachusetts sports bars and restaurants will be ready for the match. A bill signed by Governor Maura Healey on Monday temporarily allows bars and other establishments licensed to serve alcohol to keep pouring for another hour until 3 a.m. and authorizes public consumption of alcohol in locally designated areas through July 31st. Healey said the temporary extension of last call will allow bars and restaurants to take advantage of an influx of visitors to the Bay State as it hosts several World Cup matches and other major events this summer. It will also support our local businesses and regional economies as they see a surge in visitors, she said in a statement. We're grateful to our partners in the legislature for getting this bill across the finish line in time for the World Cup, as well as to the hardworking staff at our bars and restaurants for providing a welcoming and joyful environment for residents and visitors alike. Lawmakers who pushed the changes through over the past week say it will help cities and towns showcase their downtowns, waterfronts, cultural districts, and restaurants, and give small businesses the opportunity to get a piece of the action by staying open later. Statewide, the last call for alcohol is currently 2 a.m. We are all on the same team for this one. Massachusetts is giving cities and towns the chance to keep the party going, said State Senator Barry Feingold, Democrat from Andover, co-chairman of the legislature's Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies, and a co-sponsor of the legislation. The World Cup is expected to draw large crowds and boost local economies across Massachusetts, with watch parties, community events, and tourism driving spending. 7 matches will be held at Gillette Stadium, renamed Boston Stadium, for World Cup play from June 13th to July 9th. A highly anticipated quarterfinal is scheduled for the last day. Massachusetts is also hosting events to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution, as well as the Sail Boston Festival in July, which will feature a parade of tall ships around the Boston Harbor. Those events are also expected to draw visitors to the state. A spokesperson for the Massachusetts chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Driving said the group supports the uniform statewide cutoff limit on alcohol sales to prevent bar crawling to establishments with later closing times. This uniform time helps prevent bar hopping to find one last drink at establishments with later closing times, the organization said in a statement. Far too often, the search for one last drink results in drunk driving. Establishments across the Commonwealth must all have the same last call time. Two screenings this week of locally filmed documentary, The Last Witch. The producers of the locally filmed upcoming documentary feature, The Last Witch, will host two early screenings this week, including a panel discussion and questions and answers. The Last Witch, which has been filmed in the area since 2022, tells the story of the successful efforts of North Andover Middle School teacher Carrie LaPierre's civics class in working to bring about the exoneration of Elizabeth Johnson, Jr., who was convicted of witchcraft in 1693 and had never been legally exonerated until 2022. With support from the North Andover Cultural Council and in partnership with the North Andover Historical Society, the first screening and educational panel presentation will be held on Wednesday, June 10th at the North Andover Historical Society at 800 Massachusetts Avenue, North Andover at 6:30 p.m. The event is free, but space is limited, so reservations are requested through the event Facebook page. The panel, which will be moderated by the film's producer and president of Salem Historical Tours, Giovanni Alibiso, will include director Annika Heilmo, Salem historian and author Richard Height, and one of the stars of the documentary Middle School History and Civic Education teacher LaPierre. The second screening will be held Thursday, June 11th at Cinema Salem at 6:30 p.m. An interview with Heilmo will be followed by audience Q&A. The Salem event is also free, but reservations are requested and the Facebook page. The events are conversations with members of the project about the story, the filmmaking journey, and the themes explored in the film, which are more relevant than ever today, Heilmo said. Everyone is welcome to join us for either or both events and gain an opportunity to connect with some of the team behind The Last Witch and learn about the creative processes of making a documentary. The documentary will include historical reenactments, interviews, and historical research relating to the Salem witch trials at locations like the Judiciary Archives in Boston, the gravesite where Johnson was buried separately from her family, and most recently, the Salem witch trials 1692 exhibit at the Peabody Essex Museum. We are so close to completing the film, which not only tells a uniquely Massachusetts story, but celebrates some wonderful young people in the whole community, Heilmo said. Many of the students are now about to graduate high school and set off on their adult journeys, committed to civic engagement with the skills to participate fully as members of a democratic society. Our film has made a real difference in many people's lives and the local area, as well as highlighting the vital need for civic education in school, an area where Massachusetts continues to lead the way, she said. For more information on the screenings, contact Alibiso at GiovanniAlibiso@thelastwitchfilm.com or call 978-745-0666. Great Marsh Brewing to be sold at auction. The status of Great Marsh Brewing Company may soon be determined. The 12,000-square-foot brewery, which seats 225 and several large German stainless steel fermentation tanks inside, are slated to be auctioned off Wednesday, June 10th at 1 p.m. The planned auction is part of a foreclosure proceeding for the property at 99 Main Street, Route 133, according to a legal notice published recently in the Gloucester Daily Times. Said premises are to be sold and conveyed subject to and with the benefit of all mortgages, restrictions, easements, improvements, outstanding tax titles, municipal or other public taxes, assessments, federal and state tax liens, reads the notice. Efforts Friday to reach Great Marsh Brewing owner and head brewmaster John Collins were unsuccessful. When asked about the property in 2025, Collins, a Hamilton restaurant, said that while the tap room was open, the restaurant had been closed for more than a year, being rented out for private events. It's a nice space and a lot of money has gone into it, he said at the time. We want to find someone who has a good plan for the place and does something with it. Great Marsh is a state-of-the-art production brewery with canning and warehouse areas, a dedicated tap room, and a separate full-service restaurant with expansive marsh views. The two-story building was built and outfitted in 2019 to 2020. Collins also bought the Fin and Feather building at 106 Main Street when he built the brewery. It is also part of the auction, according to auctioneer Aaron Posnick and Company of West Springfield. Under the terms of the planned sale, the auction will be conducted by the holder of the mortgage for the brewery, Newburyport 5-Cent Savings, Newburyport Bank. The sale will include personal property on the premises. When contacted Friday, Newburyport Bank officials had no comment regarding the auction. Ann Cameron, chair of the Board of Selectmen, said she hopes the situation will eventually be resolved. I really know nothing about this, she said. I hope to see a thriving business in that space. Sam Bevins, CEO of the Greater Cape Ann Chamber of Commerce, said, it is always disappointing to see a business close, particularly one that occupied such a prominent location on the Essex Causeway. Business closures affect employees, customers, and the broader community, and we never like to see commercial properties sit vacant, Bevins said. That said, we remain hopeful that the property will attract a new owner and a new use in relatively short order. Bevins said the facility is a significant commercial site and located in a highly visible location. Essex continues to be a desirable place to do business, he said. We look forward to seeing the property contribute to the local economy and community in its next chapter. Should the auction proceed, the purchaser will need to be present to present compensation for the potential deal. A deposit of $150,000 by a certified check or bank check shall be paid by the purchaser at the time and place of sale, the legal notice reads. In addition, an additional deposit representing 10% of the purchase price of the property shall be paid for by the purchaser within 5 days from the time of the sale. All deposits are to be held in escrow with Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, LLP, 28 State Street in Boston. St. John's prepped to transform dining hall in $27.5 million project. St. John's Prep broke ground on a transformative $27.5 million project last week to upgrade the campus's century-old Memorial Dining Hall into the Memorial Student Commons. This work includes expanding and modernizing the hall's kitchen and serving facilities, creating flexible gathering spaces for programming and mentoring, adding a dining area for faculty, staff, and relocating the school's student life offices to the building, the prep said in a statement. The Memorial Student Commons represents our commitment to creating spaces that strengthen relationships and support the formation of young men, head of school Edward P. Hardiman said in a statement. Hardiman was joined at the June 4th groundbreaking by the prep's board of trustees, project partners from Flansburg Architects, Procon, and Scalora Consulting Group, representatives from the project's lending partner, Salem 5 Bank, representatives from Sage Dining Services, and alumni, donors, and community supporters. Construction will continue through the upcoming school year, the prep said. The new Memorial Student Commons is expected to open in August 2027 ahead of the first day of classes. For nearly 100 years, Memorial Dining Hall has been a gathering place for our community. This transformation honors that legacy while creating a vibrant center where students can connect with one another and experience the relation-centered environment that is at the heart of a St. John's Prep education, Hardiman said. The project is a cornerstone of Vision 2032, a plan to enhance the school using feedback from prep community members in honor of the school's 125th anniversary in 2032. The plan seeks to make capital improvements to the campus, increase endowment, create a new enrollment management strategy that sustains a vibrant, diverse student body, and enhances curriculum, according to the school's website.